face. Hello and welcome to another Weekly Stuff bonus podcast, Doctor Who edition.
Yes, we are here again.
I'm Jonathan Lack.
I'm Sean Chapman.
We are now, this month, finally going to get around to the rocky, shall we say, tenure of the Sixth Doctor.
Yeah.
A period that for modern Doctor Who fans may seem pretty alien, because this is a period when the Doctor was, shall we say, Sean, in distress.
You might even sing it, you know, from the top of the mountains, Jonathan, that yes, this will be an interesting episode for a number of reasons, because the story we will be talking about is Vengeance on Varus, which is a great, great Doctor Who story. I love Vengeance on Varus. You watched it for the first time, your initial impressions?
Very good, maybe not great, definitely the best Sixth Doctor story I've seen.
Yeah, which is, you've seen a couple of them at this
I've seen this one, I've seen a Revelation of the Daleks, right. I've seen...
The Twin Dilemma.
Yeah,
he did that on a podcast also.
I've seen a lot of his first season, I haven't seen any of Trial of the Time Lord.
Yeah, because you kind of have to watch that in a set.
Right.
Like, the frame narrative doesn't really work. But yeah, so, the thing that's interesting about the Sixth Doctor is that he only has two seasons... but was on for over the course of 3 years, basically, because there was the big hiatus in the middle, the 18-month hiatus that we will talk about. In terms of the amount of screen time there is to talk about the Sixth Doctor, there's not a lot, but there's so much stuff that happened behind the scenes. It's such a seismic shift in the history of the show. This is like the point where things start heading towards the eventual cancellation in 1989. So there's a lot of behind the scenes drama, a lot of weird figures involved, and a lot of desperate attempts to turn the show around, ultimately to no avail.
So if you've been following this, you know, mini series of podcasts we've been doing from the First Doctor to now, this is, correct me if I'm wrong, this is probably one of the harder ones to pick a representative story for.
Oh, yeah.
But also, you've told me many times the story was obvious this time.
Yeah, like Vengeance on Varus, I think, was an easy pick for me, because I think it's easily my favorite Sixth Doctor story. It's one of those of, like, I can't pick a Trial of a Time Lord one, because that's just weird. I'm not going to pluck a story from the middle of that, because for those who don't know, Trial of a Time Lord is 14 episodes. That's like its own season, but it's kind of like divvied up into four episodes, and then the last two episodes are kind of like a mini story. And it's sort of weird because they're mostly, like, it's mostly normal Doctor Who serials that then just cut away to this, like, really bad courtroom drama that frames it all, but, like, doesn't really work. So, like, pulling one of those stories out of Trial of the Time Lord would just be confusing. You're then left with his only other season that he did, of which, like, the quality is very up and down, with, like, the ups are usually not that high. The couple of downs, like Twin Dilemma, are very low. Well, I guess technically Twin Dilemma is at the end of the Fifth Doctor's last season, but who fucking cares about that?
Creating the greatest qualitative shift in Doctor Who history?
Basically, yeah. But yeah, so, like, the Sixth Doctor's stories are generally not very good, but I have a deep fondness for Vengeance on Varus, and I think it does represent a couple of things. Of you start getting the sense of the ways that like Margaret Thatcher London and like or England and the UK is affecting the show, and like the sort of like the heavy conservatism, social and like fiscal conservatism that is ruling the UK government, and like equivalently it's like think of Thatcher as kind of like Reagan. Because they were contemporaries, obviously Reagan being the president of the United States, Thatcher being the prime minister of the UK. And you can see I think Vengeance on Varus is commenting on that stuff a little bit. That is stuff that also the conservatism, at like then getting into the BBC in certain ways, is I think some of the ways that eventually lead to the show's cancellation and stuff like that. So I think Varus is good to look at for that. I also think Colin Baker is really good in this story. I think Nicola Bryant is good in this story. We'll talk about stuff with Perry, but like I think she does some of her better work in Vengeance on Varus. And it's just, it's a, It's a very, like, distinctly mid-80s Doctor Who story that is also very good.
It has the fundamentals down pat. Like, it is a good speculative science fiction story.
Yeah.
It is a good allegory. It's well told. It has a fairly good sense of pace. I will say I've never loved the two-episode, 44-minute thing they did this season.
Yeah.
I think that breaks the pace of both episodes to a certain degree. But, you know, can't help that. And, yeah, it's a really interesting one to talk about. And I just want to say up front, like, get this out of the way. Sometimes I think in Doctor Who fan conversations, it's tough to separate Colin Baker's Doctor from the era of Colin Baker's Doctor.
Right.
And it's easy to say, like, oh, well, he's the weakest Doctor because his is the weakest era. Which I think no one's probably going to argue against this being the roughest Doctor Who era, right?
Yes, yeah. That is my opinion. I think it's most people's opinion.
But I think Colin Baker is a great fucking Doctor, and you can fight me on that.
No,
I love Colin Baker.
I 100% agree. I think even in bad stories, he 100% pulls his weight. And then especially, you know, once he's given, like unequivocally good scripts in the Big Finish audio dramas, when they started doing that in the early 2000s, like, he knocks it out of the park every single time, which sort of, like, proves that once you take away some of, like, the falling building that was crumbling around Colin Baker, that, like, he fucking stands up as the Doctor.
I really think, like, even, and seeing him in a genuinely good story like Vengeance on Varos, like, you can debate the degree of good, but it's a very good story.
Yeah.
I got a sense out of this that, like, man, if he had had, like, the quality of a Hinchcliffe Holmes era behind him,
right,
I think he could have been as big as Tom Baker in his own way. I think he has a very different, unique, quirky perspective on the Doctor that kind of has that Tom Baker quality or that Patrick Troughton quality that you could kind of go anywhere with this guy.
Yeah.
I think you could tell just about any kind of Doctor Who story with him, and you can go from comedy to horror very effectively, as Vengeance on Varos frequently does. And I just, it's always a shame. Because, like, the other thing that's worth talking about when we get into it is, like, part of the falling building is the utter lack of production values at this point.
Yeah.
Like, there's, near the end of Vengeance on Varos, there's a part where they're in, like, an underground forest kind of thing that looks cool. Other than that, like, they were making Doctor Who, they were rubbing two nickels together to make this show at this point.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing, is, like, Colin Baker is having to act his ass off to sell these things, and you just, you feel for him, because I think he had a special take on this character that never got to, on TV, fully flourish.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So before we dive into Vengeance on Varos itself, we have to talk about the era, like, more than on any of these other episodes, we have to talk about the behind-the-scenes stuff and the era that informs the Sixth Doctor, because it is so, because I think it is so present on the screen, even in the stories I really like Vengeance on Varos. Like you said, you can tell that, like, this is a show that the broader sort of, like, the heads that are sort of controlling it, the corporate heads, the Sills of the world, one might say, are not like really behind the show at this point. And this is where the BBC basically starts turning its back on Doctor Who, and, like, and turning its back is a nice way to say, like, actively trying to force the show to cancellation through more or less any means they can think of.
This is the difference between British and American TV. When American corporations don't like a show, they just cancel it.
Yeah.
And then bring it back 20 years later now. But when British corporations don't like a show, they are passive-aggressive towards it for the better part of a decade, and then cancel it.
Basically, yeah. That's more or less what happened. So sort of to briefly recap what we talked about with the Fifth Doctor podcast was John Nathan Turner taking over as producer for Tom Baker's last season. And so he is the producer for all of the 80s in Doctor Who, like, and rides that ship down until it eventually the show is canceled.
And he's the captain who went down with the ship.
Basically, and not by choice. It's like, that's something there'll be more to talk about with the Seventh Doctor, but John Nathan Turner did not want to stay with the show as long as he was basically forced to stay with the show, or would have been canceled if he had decided not to be the producer anymore.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, he was just basically, like, strapped into that seat whether he wanted to be in it or not. So John Nathan Turner is still the producer for the Sixth Doctor era. Eric Sayward, who was basically the script editor for the Fifth Doctor era, like, barring, like, a little bit of weirdness in that first season, he is the script editor for all of Colin Baker's run, with the exception of, I think, the last two episodes of Trial of the Time Lord. I think he technically leaves there over creative differences with John Nathan Turner. And we'll probably go into a little bit of that as well. But so that the behind the scenes team for the Sixth Doctor era did not really change from the Fifth Doctor era. They kind of bring on some different writers, like Pip and Jane Baker pop up a couple of times in the Sixth Doctor era and stuff like that. But broadly speaking, it's the same kind of people making the show as with the Fifth Doctor. But Peter Davison, after spending 3 years playing the Doctor, took Patrick Troughton's advice, who kind of like famously told him, you know, play it for 3 years and then leave to avoid being typecast. So Peter Davison said, okay, that's what I will do. And he did that. Left the show, which left then Jonathan Turner having to obviously recast the character. And Colin Baker appeared in, I think it's Arc of Infinity, which is a Doctor Who story with Peter Davison. And he appears like as this weird sort of like Time Lord security guard guy, kind of a background-ish character. Like has a couple of lines, but not much. And they take him. He's not a particularly well-known actor. It's not like Peter Davison was pretty famous for being in All Creatures Great and Small. Colin Baker just, they kind of like plucked him out of nowhere and then cast him as the Doctor and had this idea of like they had kind of two ideas. One was, let's make the Doctor dark and mysterious and kind of strange and alien again, because obviously we talked a lot with the Peter Davison's era of him being this sort of like weird milquetoast Doctor that kind of like the Doctor that you kind of like had around and you would hug him and like go on adventures like holding hands together. Just like he wasn't like this big leading man sort of like alien presence in the show. And they wanted to get back to that sort of the core of the character with William Hartnell. And the other thing they decided to do that we sort of alluded to was, instead of the traditional thing where, you know, the leaving Doctor leaves and like regenerates at the end of their last episode and you see the face of the new Doctor and then it smashes to credits and then the next season is when you get to see the new person playing the Doctor. Instead, you get The Caves of Androzani, which is easily one of the best Doctor Who stories, which is where Peter Davison bows out. And then The Twin Dilemma, the next story, is where Colin Baker now has to play the role, and it is the last story of that season, and it is not very good, I think is an easy way to put it. We covered it in an episode around the time, it must have been around Deep Breath, right?
Yeah, when Peter Capaldi came on, we looked back at some regeneration stories.
Yeah, so if you want to hear more detailed thoughts in my, like, desperate attempts to try to explain to you the plot of what happened to a story we had watched, like, the previous day, you can go listen to that. The Twin Dilemma is, like, in short, utterly incomprehensible as a story. Colin Baker is good in it, and there are interesting ideas there. But they sort of do this weird thing where to try to make him feel like dangerous and alien, they have him choke Perry like as one of the first things he does on the show, as like in his like regenerative fugue state. He just kind of chokes her out and then like realizes, oh, what am I doing? And it's something that you can understand the reasoning and like kind of what they're going for, but the execution is not all the way there with it. I think it's like they kind of get it off on the wrong foot.
I think to even it out, in Jodie Whittaker's first scene in the new season, she should wake up and immediately like choke the male nurse who is attending to her, because she's obviously going to wake up in a hospital because that's what happens to the Doctor. I think that would be a great way to start the next era.
I think they need to up the ante though, and instead of just choking him out, she should like look around and like grab a scalpel and just like stab him in the stomach with it. Just like you got to get a bit more violent each time. But yeah, it was something of that. The idea with the Sixth Doctor was to have him start very strange and violent and weird and be like, oh, this is so different than the Fifth Doctor. Like, holy crap. And then you would slowly sort of, and this is an idea that maybe sounds familiar to you from Peter Capaldi and the Twelfth Doctor, because it's kind of what they did with season 8, was like you kind of peel back the layers and then get back to the sort of like chummy, nice, friendly, huggable Doctor. And make it interesting because it's part of the character arc. It's not just an assumption you make about the character. And you can see with Peter Capaldi that when you have, you know, like all the resources and everything and the people to make that happen and work, it's fucking awesome. And it makes like for me, like one of the most interesting, like best incarnations of the Doctor that embodies all the kindness and warmth of the character because he has to earn it instead of just having those character traits. So it's like, in an ideal world, what they were going for was really interesting, but it kind of, especially in when couched with the BBC being more and more upset with how violent the show was, starting off with your main character being very violent towards this young female companion was like immediate, like both the fans started rejecting him, and then that was one of the many things that then made the BBC look like, maybe we don't need Doctor Who anymore.
Well, like, it's also, there's the idea is good of making the Doctor dark, maybe, but there is something to be said for maybe the best way to illustrate that is not to have him wake up and choke his female companion.
Yeah.
Like, It is hard to come. Like, imagine if Deep Breath started with Peter Capaldi choking Jenna Coleman. It would be really hard to buy some of the stuff in their relationship, you know?
Yeah.
And also imagine if Deep Breath were the end of one season and you had to wait a full year after watching him choke Jenna Coleman to come back to it. Like, that's also part of the problem, I assume, with the Twin Dilemma, is that if you had ended on Caves of Androzani, everyone would be so fucking excited for that next season. If you end on the Twin Dilemma, everyone's just confused.
Yeah, so the Twin Dilemma aired basically March 1984, and so you didn't get any more Colin Baker until January of 1985. So you go almost a full year with, like, this weird new guy playing the role that, and, like, then going for this weird experimental thing, and it is like, if you're trying to do the character arc thing, it's like you need the consistent time, like, with the character to execute that. You can't, like, have the first chapter of their big character arc and then take a year off and then expect people to sort of pick it up and be like, okay, now I'm, like I'm invested to see where they take this character. They started him off as being fairly unlikable, but how are they going to develop that? That's, like, you don't get any of that nuance when you have that sort of, like, scheduling and production stuff. And that's some of those areas where it's like, you know, that was basically John Nathan Turner's decision to do that, and it was probably not a very good idea.
No.
Yeah, so that's sort of, you, like, immediately, basically, Colin Baker is, you know, shot in the foot with his run on the show. Other things that happen is, because I think we should just talk about it now, since we're talking about the beginning of his run, is I have a personal deep fondness for Colin Baker's costume as the Doctor. I think it looks fucking awesome, and he pulls it off. But Colin Baker in no way ever wanted that costume. He did not pick it out. That was not, like, he wasn't edging for. He wasn't, like, suggesting this, like, Technicolor weird dream coat garish monster that he's wearing. Like, Colin Baker has, basically, in every single interview he gives, he's always said, like, he wanted something that was, like, austere and sort of, like proper and black. And, like, that's, like, the kind of, like, a William Hartnell kind of thing was what he was going for. And John Nathan Turner decided, instead of this austere, sort of severe, very, like, British gentleman, like, black gentleman's coat, instead we're going to put you in this Technicolor Rainbow Nightmare, and then put some fucking question marks on your collar and suspender just to flip the finger. It's just like, there's nothing at all austere about wearing a fucking question mark on your collar and on your suspenders. It's one of those things that you look at as like, I do really enjoy the way the costume ultimately came out, and I think it looks good on Colin Baker, even if he didn't like it. But you want your actor to be able to, like, be comfortable in their costume, right?
There's a reason why whenever you hear, like, in Modern Who about a new Doctor being cast and the costume, it's all like, oh, we talked to Matt Smith or David Tennant or now Jodie Whittaker or whatever, and, like, they gave us this and we gave them this, and it was a back and forth about what they wanted the character to be, and it's because the costume is like, you know, the Doctor is this huge role. You're in it, you know, 13 hours a day for months on end. It's a huge part of your performance. Like, look at how Tom Baker uses that scarf. Like, the Fourth Doctor doesn't exist without the costume. Like, and it's true for all of them. And then you have Colin Baker, and I agree that I think the costume looks pretty funny and, like, interesting to look at. I also think it's so at odds with his performance. And, like, you can kind of tell, because he's not, he doesn't get to use that costume the way other Doctors get to use their costumes. Like, I don't know what Sylvester McCoy's relationship with his costume was. It's also fairly flamboyant by Doctor Who standards. But he also really makes use of it in a way that, like, he's able to bring it into his performance. I don't really think Colin Baker is. Like, there is a quality to Vengeance on Varos where you'll be watching it and he'll be running down a corridor or something, like, in this episode, dark shit will be happening, you know. Like, let's say he murders two people by throwing them into an acid bath.
He did and not throw them. One of them tripped, and then the one that tripped and fell in, like, reached up and pulled the other one in. Let's be precise.
Okay. He inadvertently causes the deaths of two people by acid bath.
Thank you. Acid manslaughter.
Yes, acid manslaughter. And when the camera pulls back and he's in the amazing Technicolor Doctor coat, it is a little jarring, because it's like, that's why would this Doctor choose to wear that costume?
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
It's especially, like, one of the things that really sort of is frustrating about it is that the overall aesthetic of the show that has started developing over the course of the Fifth Doctor period, I think it's, like, in the, like, middle of with the Sixth Doctor stuff, is it just has this really dark, kind of unpleasant look to it.
It stops using color, interestingly. Like, yeah. I think throughout the Third and Fourth Doctor eras, like, especially the Third Doctor, because Color was new and they were so excited about it. But Color is a really interesting element that I think they use very thoughtfully. And I agree. I think the fifth, I think the John Nathan Turner years generally, the color is pretty garish. Which a lot of 80s stuff is, to be fair, but yeah.
It is the thing about this era, one of the reasons why I tend not to like to go back to it, even for the stories that I like, is that it is just sort of defined by a certain unpleasantness to me, which I think Vengeance on Varos generally is pretty good at using in a thematic way, but there are plenty of stories that's like are not about like this like dark, sort of like unpleasant society, and this sort of like trying to do the like hold up a mirror to society, like do all that stuff that Varos is trying to do. And there are other stories that are like, this is a fairly sort of like normal, pleasant Doctor Who story that just looks unpleasant to look at. It's just that there's the quality of the some of the direction, and then just like the look of the video and the production is just like, it's not nice. It's something that clashes so much with having this like really bright, colorful coat that if you can imagine like, if modern Doctor Who had a look kind of like that, in the way that like Jodie Whittaker's costume is not anywhere near that garish, but has more of that sort of like bright, colorful look to it than certainly like Peter Capaldi's costume or Matt Smith's did, or even like any of the modern Doctors have.
Yeah, the only
more
Doctor
sort of, like,
who
downish kind of color.
Yeah, the only Doctor in modern times has a significant amount of color is Tennant when he's in the blue costume.
Yeah,
but other than that, it's all like blacks and grays, and Capaldi does have the red coat sometimes.
Yeah,
which is
and
great.
Like sort of like the brighter linings and stuff like that. But generally, you know, there's sort of like been more austere sort of costumes. But yeah, you can see with Jodie Whittaker, and you can see with like the little like production stills and stuff we've seen of what they're going for that costume that's a bit more bright and colorful and fun looking, is that with the right production values and everything in the right sort of visual style, that can look awesome. And I can, in my mind's eye, when I think about Colin Baker, and like when if I'm listening to the audio dramas and I'm like sort of imagining what's happening, in my mind's eye, like that costume looks fucking great, because I think it particularly matches Colin's like weird, fuzzy, like brownish blonde hair. There's something about the whole look that I think ideally it could have looked so awesome.
Yes.
But it does not most of the time.
Yes. And you would... There's a lot of things around the costume that would have to be different for it to work.
Yes, the whole production design and the cinematography and the quality of the video would have to back that up.
It's kind of like the same if you took the Third Doctor's costumes and put them in this era. I don't think it would work because one, you're not in the '60s, '70s. I mean, I know that the Third Doctor is technically '70s, but it's a super '60s aesthetic through all his episodes, and like, that wouldn't work on that level, but also like the way it uses color and location shooting and stuff, that sort of thing works. It would be weird if on like the all studio stuff you have here, I think that's actually another part of the issue, is that in the brief moments when Colin Baker gets to be outside, which is super rare in this era, I actually think that costume can look pretty great. I think Revelation of the Daleks at the beginning, they're on location.
Yeah, there's little bit in Revelation of the Daleks, and like they're going over the wall and all that stuff.
It looks great there. I think it looks good with sun on it. In studio lighting, it has issues.
Yeah, and Colin Baker definitely has a very high percentage of like studio-based episodes. This one is like that Twin Dilemma is basically all studio stuff. The Two Doctors is actually pretty outside. Time Lash is all studio, and like most of Trial of the Time Lord is in the studio. Obviously, all the trial stuff is. But yeah, so that's the costume, which is another thing that sort of shoots Colin Baker in the foot. It's just like a pile of like, it's like the death of a thousand cuts, basically, with what happened to Colin Baker. So then he has his first season, which is up and down. Obviously, Vengeance on Varos, I think, is very good. There's a couple of other decent stories in there. Nothing that great.
Can I ask your thoughts on The Two Doctors? I've always been curious about that one.
It's really uneven. This is something, maybe we'll just sort of like talk about it now, is that Robert Holmes was pretty unwell at this point. And one of the reasons, like ultimately, the creative split that happened to John Nathan Turner and Eric Saward was that Robert Holmes writes The Mysterious Planet, which is the first four episodes of Trial of a Time Lord, and then he was supposed to write the last two episodes as well, and he only finished the script for the first of those two episodes, and then was hospitalized and eventually died before he could write the second one. And Eric Saward basically wanted to follow the plan that Robert Holmes had for like what that episode was going to be, and which would have ultimately ended on a cliffhanger. And John Nathan Turner did not want to do that, and so then he brought in Pip and Jane Baker to write a like script that to credit to them, like with the conditions they were set upon to write that script, they did a very good job of finishing that story arc when they were not involved in any of that stuff. Like they just kind of came in at the last second. But that was like the thing that happened of Robert Holmes, obviously, like the heart and soul of Doctor Who for so long, and did come back in the end, but was ill, like, even during writing The Two Doctors, which was a couple of years before Trial of the Time Lord. And you can tell that, like, you can tell that there is stuff going on. That is also, like, the production behind the scenes is not working really well for that. Like, there's still a lot of good stuff in The Two Doctors. Patrick Troughton is obviously fucking awesome. But, like, there's only so much you can do. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so The Two Doctors is a weird one. It's well worth a watch, but it's a very strange story. Anyway, so that's... Yeah, so he gets the... Colin Baker gets that season, and that's when you have a couple of figures that need to be talked about at the BBC get involved. It's basically two main figures then kind of, like, work together to put the show on hiatus. Like, originally it was, like, basically canceled, and then it was, like, became a hiatus after a whole lot of hullabaloo. You have Jonathan Powell, who was at the time the head of drama at the BBC, which was the department that the Doctor Who was being made in. And then Jonathan Powell would eventually become controller of BBC One, and then in that position was he would then eventually ultimately cancel the show in 1989. But he, like, even as head of drama, he did not like the scripts, he did not like the show, and he didn't want the, he didn't like Colin Baker, he didn't like anything. He also, he did not like John Nathan Turner, to the point where he has been quoted as saying in a book that was eventually written about this era, that he wished that John Nathan Turner would fuck off, fix it, or die, really. So it's like, you can only imagine the kind of conditions you have to be in to work that, like, the person that's, like, directly above you that has to deal with, like, everything of how you're getting your budget and that kind of stuff is someone who wishes that you would fuck off or die. It's not the most pleasant circumstances in which to, like, in which to embark upon a creative endeavor, right?
Yes.
So that's Jonathan Powell. Then you also have Michael Grade, who was the controller of BBC One, which I always love this, like, such a weird title of, like, yes, the TV controller. It's very British sounding. But he was the controller of BBC One. He became that in 1984. And so that was, like, you know, basically when Colin Baker came on the scene. And so then in 1985, he decided, like, spending too much money on this Doctor Who thing. It's crap. It's too violent. It's too dark. It's supposed to be a kid's show, even though it's not made with the kid shows. It's made with the dramas and all this shit. And he basically decided, like, to, like, no, it's done, no more Doctor Who, which then caused a huge outpouring of
support. So this was at the end of Baker's first season.
Yes, at the end of his first season, that's where the hiatus happens, because fans came out and was like, fuck you, like, this is Doctor Who, it's been on the air since fucking 1963. Like, this is one of the weird things to think about is, like, Colin Baker basically grew up with William Hartnell as the Doctor, right? Like, they were already at the point in the history of the show where both Peter Davison and Colin Baker were fans of the show when they were younger and then came on. Like this, that's not a new Doctor Who thing. That was happening in classic Doctor Who already. That's, like, that's how long the legacy of the show was.
This was season 22, right?
Yes.
Where exactly. It's canceled, yeah.
Yeah, and they had already had, like, the Five Doctors, which was the 25th anniversary special. Like, they had already done all that stuff. And so, like, you know, you have multiple generations of fans that came out in support of the show. And this is where we then have to talk about the drastic measures that everyone involved with the show made to try to bring the show back and make sure that this was only a hiatus and not a full cancellation. And so a lot of people involved with the production got together and they made a charity song called Doctor in Distress in the guise of something, you know, like, I can't, what, can you think of what are the other examples of this sort of format? Because you don't get it that, I guess we had one for, what am I thinking of? We've had a couple of these recently for different disasters involved with, like, the hurricanes and everything.
Oh, sure. I was going to say, like, We Are the World or something.
Yeah, well, yeah, We Are the World. There is the one that the Hamilton guy made for Lin-Manuel
Miranda made for Puerto Rico.
Yeah. So it's like you get this every now and then. I feel like it's not as common these days as it was in the 80s, where it seems like it was happening every other day in the 80s.
Yeah, like Sun City, which is the apartheid song
from
the late 80s. Yeah.
Yeah, so in the height of all of that, instead of making a song that was, like, about apartheid or about, like, some huge natural disaster that had happened, they decided we're going to make a song called Doctor in Distress to try to make sure that Doctor Who is not off the air. I do have to say, to their credit, the money, like, the proceeds they got did go to cancer research. So it's not like they did just line their pockets with the, because, you know, it's not like you're not fucking donating the money to the BBC or something. So it's like they did ultimately take the money to a good cause. But Doctor in Distress is a bad song. You watched it this morning for the first time, Jonathan. What are your...
What do you mean, bad song, Sean? This is a glorious song. Doctor in Distress. We're sending out an SOS. It's great.
It's
great. It is one of the most amazing pieces of Doctor Who history, and I say that without irony.
It is. That is a really good way to put it. It is, like, in some ways, the most appropriate thing for me to pick to talk about on this episode in terms of the representative of the era was not any of the Colin Baker stories. It is this song.
This song
is the most 80s Doctor Who thing that was ever made.
It is Colin Baker, a couple of mostly very disengaged Doctor Who stars, and a bunch of random non-celebrities clearly reading the lyrics for the first time off of a piece of paper while being filmed for a fairly bad song with fairly bad, like, early 80s CGI effects as they are begging for the life of their show that has no resources anymore. It is much more probably representative of this era than Vengeance on Varos is.
Yeah, it is absolutely ridiculous. One of my favorite little, like, elements to this is that the fake, like, artist or whatever they created to put the song out under is called Who Cares? Which is, like, you can... When you think about it for a second, you know what they're going for is, like, the assumption that everybody cares because it's Doctor Who. But when you're Michael Grade or Jonathan Powell and you see this record that comes out called Doctor Distress, and on a big box on the front of it says Who Cares? ? They're like, exactly. Who cares? Like, they canceled the show.
I want there to be a future episode of Doctor Who. Chris Chibnall, Jody Whittaker, you can borrow this free pitch called Who Cares? Where the doctor, like, it can be about some natural disaster in the world. Like, I don't know, the doctor arrives in Puerto Rico right after the hurricane and is like, I know how to help. One of my new companions is a musician. We're an amateur musician by night, not by day, because, you know, this song. And we're going to go record a charity single with the doctor as the lead. That should be an episode of Doctor Who, and it can be called Who Cares? And it'll be great.
Yeah. No, it's just... It's one of those things that if you're going to pick the title Who Cares for something, you have to be fully aware and ready to accept that Who Cares is a phrase that means totally different things if you say it earnestly versus if you say it sarcastically. And people mostly say it sarcastically. Like, you don't usually go around and, like, hear someone, like, people arguing about something and then someone's like, but who cares? It's like, everyone cares. It's like, no, it's like, oh, who cares? Like, that's how people use that phrase. Another interesting detail about Doctor Distress is the sort of composer and writer for it, Ian Levine, was later described the single as an absolute balls-up fiasco. It was pathetic and bad and stupid. It tried to tell the Doctor Who history in an awful high-energy song. It almost ruined me. Which is a really severe thing to say about a song you wrote, is that it almost ruined me.
It's so funny because it really does have this quality of being so earnest you can't dislike it. Like,
sure,
there's not, like, a bad bone in its body, but it is so inept. Like, really, like, watch the music video. The funniest thing to me is cutting to all the people singing, and they all just have their notes in front of them looking at the words, and they are all clearly disengaged. Like, some of them, like, Colin Baker wants to be there.
Of course, it's his fucking job.
It's his fucking job. But, like, they are all, like, seeing these words for the first fucking time, and it is kind of hilarious. And yes, in trying to summarize the history of the show, oh boy, it has some funny ways to...
Yeah.
You know what this was so funny. So I listened to this, like, three times today because I couldn't get it out of my head.
Uh-huh.
And then for whatever reason, this made me think of, and I actually think it's not a bad comparison, it put in my head the Ballad of Bilbo Baggins song that Leonard Nimoy did, and yes. I listened to that on the way over to your house. And I think that's a better song and everything, but it's kind of that same thing of, like, this sort of super inept retelling of something, but also, like, it's so earnest.
Yes. So I want to, Jonathan, if you allow me, I want to do a dramatic reading.
I think I like your dramatic readings. Our listeners must like your dramatic readings, and we haven't had one in long enough. So
yeah,
let's do it.
This is Doctor in Distress, a dramatic reading by yours truly, Sean Chapman. 18 months is too long to wait. Bring back the doctor. Don't hesitate. It was a cold, wet night in November, 22 years ago. There was a police box in a junkyard. We didn't know where it would go. An old man took two teachers into time and space. It started off a legend that no other could replace. Doctor in distress, let's all answer his SOS. Doctor in distress, bring him back now. We won't take less. There were evil metal creatures who tried to exterminate. Inside each of their casings was a bubbling lump of hate. We met cybernetic humans with no feelings at all. Warriors of the ice who stood over 7 feet tall. Bring him back now, we won't take less. If we stop his travels, he will be in a mess. The galaxy will fall to evil once more, with nightmarish monsters fighting a war. We've learned to accept six doctors, with companions at their side. When they were faced with dangers, they didn't run, they didn't hide. There was a brigadier, and a master, and a canine computer. Each screaming girl just hoped that a Yeti wouldn't shoot her. Doctor in distress, let's all answer his SOS. Doctor in distress, bring him back now. We won't take less. That is...
I'm sorry, I was trying to keep a straight face for that whole thing.
That it's a really killer line. Wouldn't shoot her. Each screaming girl just hoped that a Yeti wouldn't shoot her. Which I always love the weird sort of like fixation on the Yeti monster, which is in two Second Doctor stories. And somehow people, like, whenever you're listing, or I feel like in this era of the show, whenever they are listing a bunch of Doctor Who monsters, it was like the Daleks, the Cybermen, the Ice Warriors, and the Yetis.
Are the Yeti? In any surviving stories?
They're in the one, I think Web of Fear, whatever it's called, the one that like brought back like in 2013 or something. So yes.
But we don't have the Abominable Snowman, right?
No, okay. You do not. So yeah. Yes, that's the just Yeti, funny. There's a weird fixation with that story. I also just want to shout out, my favorite part of the video by far is when they do There is a Brigadier and a Master, and it cuts to Nicholas Courtney, the Brigadier, and then Anthony Ainley, who is playing the Master at that point. And then Anthony Ainley has to sing the line, and a canine computer, which is a bad line to have to sing.
Like, Nicholas Courtney, I think they're both clearly in good spirits. Like, I think they're fans of the show. They're there for it. But, like, Nicholas Courtney gets through it just fine, and then Anthony Ainley just cracks up. Like, he can't do it.
It's having to see, and a canine computer, like, it's such a bad lyric to have to sing. It's
you can just tell, like, and Anthony Ainley also has this, they both kind of have this look on their face of just pity, like this is their, like, their nephew who's like kind of a deadbeat, and they gotta go give him some money so he can get through the next week of college. That's kind of what it looks like.
Yeah, no, it's, so if people have not, I put it up on my Twitter. People, you have to go watch this fucking music video.
I will, if I remember, I will just embed it with the article on JonathanLack.com.
Because it's
great.
It demands to be seen and to be heard. And to be fair to Doctor in Distress, the show did come back, and it was on for a couple of years. So
4 more seasons.
So, you know, maybe... It's impossible to say.
Correlation does not equal causation.
Yes,
but.
And you know, we never know what could have happened if things had gone differently. It's entirely possible that Doctor in Distress was so bad it hastened the show to an early cancellation. It would have gone longer than 1989. But then Jonathan Powell, like, saw this record somewhere and was like, right, fucking Doctor Who needs to die. I can't, who can say? Maybe it warmed their heart, and it was like a Grinch situation of, like, their heart grew 2 sizes that day, and then it, like, shrunk back, and then they're like, no, fuck this. Who knows?
I hope in the new Grinch movie that's the actual end of the movie, is it grows 2 sizes, and then he's like, nah, fuck this.
Yes, it's a modern retelling of the Grinch with what we know now about human psychology.
Yes.
Yeah, no, so, yeah, so then, like, to briefly, I guess, kind of address then what happens before we ultimately dive into Vengeance on Varos, because it is... You know, because this is this weird rocky period in the history of the show, is that they decide to what they're going to do when they finally get the show back. Because there was originally there was going to be a season 23, which is like, because this first season 22. Originally season 23, they had like a bunch of scripts commissioned. I think they had one that was basically fully written, and they were going to produce the show until they got word down that's like, no, we're taking all the money. But we're taking all, like, the 2 fucking dimes we're giving you and going to spend that on fucking EastEnders or something. And so you're going to go on hiatus or like forever until then Vince is like, okay, fine, we'll give you those two dimes back and you can make Trial of a Time Lord. So instead of making the original plan season 23, Eric Sayward and Jonathan Turner decided they're going to do this Trial of a Time Lord conceit, which I sort of like went over basically what that was. But the idea, the reason why they did it was to sort of do this weird meta narrative because the Doctor and Doctor Who were on trial in, like, the court of public opinion in Thatcher's England. And so they're like, well, fuck it. We'll just do that in the TV show.
We should also note that that coincided with a severe episode cut. Because for years and years, Doctor Who, from basically this was standardized with the third Doctor's first season. And for most seasons, it's 26 half-hour episodes. I think 28 it went up to in the Peter Davison years or something.
Yeah.
And then they made a format change for Colin Baker's first season, which was...
2 45-minute episodes instead of 2 25-minute episodes.
But it's the same roughly amount of length they'd had for years, right?
Yes. In fact, like when aired in other territories, they cut the two episodes into four episodes, which you can basically tell where that happens because they're basically four episodes of Doctor Who. They just sort of stitched two of them together.
But then with Trial of a Time Lord and on through the end of the Seventh Doctor, they're just 14-episode seasons, which, especially when you get to, like, the Seventh Doctor, you realize how much shorter that is.
Yeah.
Because it's dramatically fewer serials. They have to do, like, three-episode serials, not four episodes sometimes. It's a weird change.
Yeah, so they brought back the show in a hampered state. Yeah, that is sort of, like, crawls to that finish line, which is something that, like you can honestly, like, it was already in a hampered state. Like, particularly when you're watching some of, like, the latter Fifth Doctor stuff, you can tell. And then for, like, all the Sixth Doctor stuff, you can tell how less of a budget they had. And, like, Trial of a Time Lord would have never worked if they had the full episode count. The fact that, like, they had only 14 episodes to make meant that it's, like, you know, but they could focus on those and just, they did, you know, they got a budget cut, but like they could still focus more on having 14 episodes instead of like 28. And so, yeah, it's something that like, it's a really complicated discussion to have about why Doctor Who was getting canceled at this point, because there is this weird sort of like vicious circle of like the quality of the show did, I think, deteriorate in like multiple ways when Jonathan Turner came on. And there are like, you know, you can have your arguments about, like, the violent content and what that means. It's like, there's no way to deny that, like, it didn't become more violent, because it obviously did. Like, the Eric Sayward's era on the show as script editor, like, is markedly more violent than anything since the Hinchcliffe years.
And often without the style of the Hinchcliffe years.
Yes, I agree.
So, like, you know, like, when Hinchcliffe and Holmes would do violent stuff, it was in a aesthetic context that framed it better, like the Victorian stuff in... Talents of Wang Chiang, or the gothic horror of A Pyramids of Mars, or Brain of Morbius, or the political thriller of Deadly Assassin. It's harder to put a pin in what they're going for with the acid baths, you know?
Yeah, no, and I mean, that's what people, like, working on Visions on Varos are basically, like, say, like that scene really was not executed the way, like, it was kind of envisioned and originally drafted and stuff. But anyways, the stuff that's sort of hard to then, like, get to is then, like, the effect that has of, you know, the show sort of slightly deteriorating qualities in some ways, but still, like, able to produce, like, each season still had some great stories, you know, like, fucking, like, you know, Caves of Androzani is an all-time classic. People loved it at the time, people love it now. So it's like, you know, a show that is utterly creatively bankrupt would never be able to make an episode like Caves of Androzani or Vinces on Varus. Like, there's still obviously, like, a lot of great talent working on the show. But as the BBC starts pulling funding and starts pulling support from the show, it makes it harder and harder to make the show, which then gives the BBC and, like, people like Michael Grade and Jonathan Powell more ammo to say, well, you know, no, the show needs to be canceled because it can't do these things. And then it's like Eric Sayward and Jonathan Turner, it's like, well, we can't do those things because you keep on taking away all of our, like, resources to do the stuff you want us to be able to do. And so it's this...
Did you see the music video? This is what we've come to.
Yeah, it's like I sold my fucking shoes to make this fucking Dr. Distress video because we have no money anymore. Yeah, so it's a really complicated section in the show that's like, you know, because there's a part of me that cannot deny some of the assertions that Michael Grade and people like him at the BBC make about the quality of the show at this period. But at the same time, it's like, but, like, that's kind of a lot also your fault.
It's also like, if you have a major institution like Doctor Who on your network, you know, like a huge cultural force, and you feel the quality isn't good, the answer probably isn't to knife the show over and over like you're in prison and you're shiving it to death.
Yeah.
The answer is probably to get different people who you think would make a better show and give them the resources to do it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and it's actually kind of amazing Doctor Who has never really had to be in that position. I mean, there is the point where Philip Hinchcliffe was essentially fired because they didn't love what he... And they kind of had to for public pressure reasons and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But it still wasn't... It's not quite the same thing. You know, and they replaced him with someone who was also highly competent in Graham Williams. But like, yeah, if you felt like the John Nathan Turner thing wasn't working out, there are other people who could make Doctor Who. You know, it's a weird thing. Like, it's hard to imagine the BBC having that view on it today.
Yeah.
Especially when, like... Especially now more than ever, it's pretty obvious that there are plenty of people who will make Doctor Who for you if you want them to.
Yeah. So before we get to the Vengeance on Varos, to finish off the story, is because it's this like tragic ending of where, you know, they make trial of a Time Lord. It's like, this is also where, because actually, like, up to this point, one thing that's interesting is, like, the ratings were stable. Like, this, like, all this stuff at the BBC did not happen because the ratings were declining. The ratings, like, they got, like, 7 to 8 million viewers, like, kind of like clockwork since about the Graham Williams era. And it's, like, they were, like, hitting those numbers for years at this point. And Colin Baker's first season 100% hits that. After the hiatus, for a bunch of reasons, Trial of a Time Lord, like, tanks in the rating compared to the 7 to 8 million viewers. It's like averages, I think, something like 4 to 5 million viewers an episode. So, and then that kind of continues until the eventual cancellation of the show. That's like the show was doing utterly fine in the ratings until the BBC fucked it. And then it was like, well, you know, then they changed where it was scheduled to be opposite. I forget what it is. Like, I think it might have been EastEnders. It was one of the new sort of soap operas they were doing. And so it was like they had stiff competition. They had an 18-month hiatus. They had all this, like, drama behind the scenes. And then also, like, a cut budget and cut episode count. It's like, what do you expect the show to be able to do after you do all of that? And so then after Trial of the Time Lord, Michael Grade had Colin Baker fired. Colin Baker then refused to come back to film a regeneration scene, which is very understandable, and that John Nathan Turner was stuck in the position of having to cast another actor as the Doctor, and so he cast Sylvester McCoy, who we'll talk about next episode. But I just wanted to sort of address that, like, this stuff does not end nicely for Colin Baker, and it's one of the things that's really sad about this era, is that he was, like, straight up fired. Like, it was not just, like, he left over creative differences. It was like they sent him a note. It's like, you're done.
Well, he has certainly been vindicated in the years since. And I think he knows that, which is good. You know, I'm glad that in his lifetime he got to come back to the role. And I think he knows he is a beloved part of the show by a big part of the audience. And he has had, you know, plenty of chances with Big Finish and whatnot to this day to stretch his legs in that role, because the main monthly range for Big Finish is still 5, 6, and 7, right?
Yeah.
Alternating.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So he still does it to this day. And because he has one of the most distinctive Doctor voices, he's very good for that.
He's just a great magnanimous person. Like, he's always the nicest guy when you see interviews with him.
Oh, yeah. You know, he also had, by far, my favorite statement of any of the Doctors when Jodie Whittaker was cast.
Yeah.
And just the most kind of, I think, full-throated endorsement of why it's important and good to have a female Doctor. And I think he's a fan of the show. I think this show, I mean, the show didn't fuck him. The BBC fucked him.
Yeah.
But he didn't have a great time with the show. I think he still clearly is out there wanting Doctor Who to be a thing. And that's awesome. And I like that there's no bitterness in him about this anymore when you hear it. And that's great. I'm glad.
Yes, no. And so let's use that to transition to Vengeance on Varos and what they like to connect it to modern Colin Baker. People who have not seen the Five-ish Doctors reboot, which was the, like, sort of comedy thing that Peter Davison, Colin Baker, and Sylvester McCoy, and then Paul McGann's and a couple other people made around the 50th anniversary. It's an utter classic. It's fucking hilarious. Now that you've, like, once you've finished, we've done the Sylvester McCoy one, then people listening to this don't have a lot of experience with the classic who can watch that and get all the fun jokes. One of those jokes being Colin Baker trapping his whole family in their house because they threw away his copy on Vengeance on Varos, because the joke is that he just sits around and watches his classic Doctor Who stories all the time. And so he locks him in their house. When he gets a new copy of it, he sits down. It's like, this was a classic. Many say that it's a classic. And good news, this DVD has more special features, even more of me. And so you can tell just how much of a good humor he has over all this stuff. And he is 100% right. I think Vincent Sanvaris is a classic. I really love this story.
I do think it's the, if I'm not mistaken, the one Colin Baker story that's gotten like a special edition DVD where it's like two discs and lots of features and stuff. They did a specific reissue of that one at some point. But yes, this is actually, I think, the longest it's ever taken us to get to the episode, but this is a big story this week.
Yes, there's a lot to talk about with Colin Baker.
So, Vengeance on Varus, can I give one of my first reactions to this that I actually think is a good way into the episode?
Yeah.
I tweeted this the other night when I was watching it. This one feels like so much of the DNA of Russell T. Davies' Doctor Who is in Vengeance on Varus. From the whole reality show trappings, the kind of very mundane social allegories of that, which Davies would use, like, completely literally in his first season finale with the Ninth Doctor, where they're it's not really an allegory at the point where it is just Big Brother and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and stuff, but very similar kind of social commentary aspect. I think the villain in this one, Syl, right?
Yeah, Syl.
That is a Russell T. Davies villain to a T. That is like every single alien he ever made. That's the Slitheen. That's the dude from Love and Monsters. That's Cassandra, the like skin woman who
I think Cassandra in particular is like a direct reference to Syl.
Yes, and so they're all over the place. Just like the general tone of this one, like it's kind of interesting because you don't often see, I think, modern Doctor... Well, okay, there's only been two modern Doctor Who showrunners. Mm-hmm. But modern Doctor Who, like, writers and staff taking a lot from this era, necessarily. Like, Stephen Moffat, I think, took much more from, like, the first four Doctors, kind of the really classic stuff. Russell T. Davies feels like he has some affinity for the 80s. And this is one that I bet if you asked him about it, he'd be like, I love Vengeance on Varus, You know?
It is something that, like... It stuck out even more to me rewatching it because I rewatched that RTD stuff so like relatively recently that seeing Vengeance on Varus, like I remembered like making that connection the last time I saw this, but it was like right like yes, RTD very clearly, whether like knowingly or just in it, because obviously he saw this, so it's like whether he knowingly took inspiration from it or subconsciously took inspiration from it, and this story kind of stuck in his head. Like, there are a lot of connections, particularly with the Ninth Doctor season. I think you see a lot of Vincent Sanvaris in that one.
Yeah, which I love that, like, that's one of the main touchstones for the return of Doctor Who, is this obscure classic, I think we can say, because it's from an obscure era.
Yeah.
You know, that is like this, you know, diamond in the rough, maybe we could say. But yeah, I mean, this episode has a super interesting framing device, if you can call it that, where the first scene is these two people on a mining colony watching TV, and we kind of see, they're kind of our POV in a lot of ways, because we cut back to them throughout, and they literally never leave that room. They're just watching the events on TV, because Varus is this weird dystopian colony where violence is there for sport, and everything kind of has a reality television component to it. I mean, like... And this is actually pretty prescient, because reality TV, as we conceive of it now, was not a thing in this time.
Yeah.
But, you know, very much almost like also like a Battle Royale or Hunger Games kind of thing going on in this as well. And then just a general commentary on TV. It actually has an interesting meta-narrative, I think, about the violence of Doctor Who and these people consuming violence. There's a lot of interesting elements to that. And it's one of my favorite things about Vengeance on Varus is that they really do follow through on that, and that those people are there watching it to the end. They never leave that room. And at the end, it's like, well, what are we going to do now? And it's one of the smartest little threads running through it. And it's a good way to kind of get into the themes of the episode, I think.
Yeah, it is one of the most sort of like directly socially conscious stories of Doctor Who from this era. Like, it is very clearly, it is a story... Like that it has a meta-narrative component to it, both like on like specifically with Doctor Who, but like in like TV consumption in general, or like, you know, like consumption of popular media, and the way that like I think this episode sort of like positions that of like it can be used as this opiate for the masses that keeps people distracted from like the severe social inequality in what under which they live, and that you have all like the people in government are ultimately being manipulated by economic forces more than anything else, which again is like would be like Margaret Thatcher's United Kingdom and the sort of like the very conservative fiscal policies that she's very famous for. Like, there is no, it's not a coincidence that this episode has all those themes, because that is the kind of thing that like if you were living, if you were a like relatively lower class person living in the UK in the 80s, you probably fucking hated Margaret Thatcher. But if you were a very well-to-do, like upper class kind of, you know, nobleman in the UK in the 80s, you probably really liked Margaret Thatcher because all of her policies was basically like, you're going to do very well under this government, not so much everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to watch this now because we're so in a moment of history repeating itself.
Yeah.
In that, like, you know, Donald Trump wears this weird populist sheep's clothing, but, well, sometimes. He doesn't do it that effectively, but he has that front, but he runs a pretty just classically American conservative government in that it's very, you know, Paul Ryan and the conservatives in power right now are just, you know, well, they're Reagan to the nth degree. I think Reagan himself would be like, not that much to the wealthy guys.
Sure,
give a little bit to the poor. But no, but like, it's Reaganomics on steroids. And you see that now again, and there's a lot of other things going on with, I think, more obvious propaganda and opiate for the masses stuff that makes Vengeance on Varos feel like
it subtle.
Has, makes it will feel subtle, but also like it has a moment right now where, like, if you watched this 10 years ago, it might feel like more commentary on the past than the present, you know what I mean?
Right.
But we're going through that again. You know, we have another conservative government back in power in the UK with Theresa May, and we have the Brexit vote, and again, a economic system that is very, very much geared regressively towards the top and things like that. So, I don't know. Vengeance on Varos is an interesting episode to watch in this moment. It has that kind of cyclical, historical relevance to it.
Yeah, because the other component with that of, like, was something that made me think, like, ooh, I have, like, this was definitely an episode I had not watched since before 2016 was, you know, because the whole system, or one of the main systems of governance that they have is all the people sitting in their weird cells watching all the shit on TV, and then every once in a while the governor comes in front of the camera and says, like, I propose this thing. It's going to be like, I propose, like, we hold off negotiations until we can get 7 credits per every, like, whatever, or of the stuff. And vote yes if you agree with me, no if you do not. And if they vote no, the governor gets bombarded with a disintegration ray, which is the one area where it's like, maybe this isn't such a bad idea if we could get the president under disintegration ray and we could just get a press a button and just see him get blasted with fucking, like, radiation. It's like, you know, it's cyclical, and you see different things in it depending on the moment of history you watch this episode in, I think. But So one of the times that I think is the first time he does that, and most of the people vote no, and he gets blasted with it, and he miraculously survives, even though it's like the third time he's been hit with this ray, and then he's like kind of stumbles out, and he has this line to me that is so prophetic, it's utterly frightening. He says, "This system of referendum, how much longer can I survive?" Which is the most, like, reading Brexit, like, obviously he's not actually reading Brexit, but, like, post-Brexit and the, like, bullshit popular referendum they did that was just, like, you need, a simple majority and you're going to leave fucking the, like, European Union. That line, "this system of referendum, how much longer can I survive," is, like, really hits chord in a way that I don't think they were really intending.
I didn't catch that, and you are right, that is scary prophetic.
Yeah,
especially in the British context, yes.
Yeah, so it is something where that social commentary for me, like, that's the stuff for me that works the best in Varus. It is that, like, there's an artfulness to the use of those two characters, Eric and Etta, that are the guy and the woman in the cell that never directly interact with anything else going on. They never meet the doctor or anything. The framing of the narrative with those two characters and the social aspect to me is really effective.
Yeah, and it actually feels like a pretty modern Doctor Who kind of technique. Like, I can imagine if that were in a post-2000s episode, they would go even more extreme with it, and, like, it would just literally be framed as them watching the events, and we wouldn't go inside the TARDIS and things like that. I could totally see that happening, you know?
Yeah.
It feels like the kind of thing where you might do that. The setup, so this is one of the 2 episode ones, as we mentioned before, so 2 45 minute episodes, although even then in my head I think of it as 4 episodes, because the breaks are pretty obvious, because like the first 25 minutes of part 1, the Doctor and Perry haven't really even gotten to Varos yet. It's a very back and forth structure. There was some stuff here in the scripting I thought could have been cleaner, and just it bounces back a lot, and it's kind of a surprisingly labored plot setup to get the Doctor to Varos. Like, it leads to some very charming scenes. This is actually the most charming I've seen Colin Baker and Perry, whatever her name is, Nicola Bryant, be on screen together. Like, their scenes in the TARDIS are fun little scenes, and I do love watching Colin Baker pout. He does have kind of that Tom Baker quality of when the Doctor just pouts. It's very fun and funny.
It is a very Tom Baker opening of, like, the TARDIS, like, is out of power, and then the Doctor decides, well, shit. He just sits down and he's like, well, it's fine for you, Perry. You're just going to die. Me, I have to live out the rest of my life in eternity in this box.
Yes. Yeah. It's very funny, but it is interesting because the weight of that first... not first whole episode, but the first half episode, is not on the Doctor and Perry at all. Like, they're cutaways, and the majority of that stretch of the episode is getting back to building the world of Varos. And it is interesting. I was surprised by how much I felt engaged with that, because I think, you know, classic Doctor Who especially is very good at building worlds and supporting casts, and it has to be, because that's such a huge part of when you have... you know, 4 to 6 episodes to work with. You have to make those things work.
Yeah.
But I often think sometimes these kind of plot setups where the Doctor isn't involved for a while can feel kind of dry. This one overall, I did like it, though, because I felt like the world they were building was pretty interesting to watch. And it's that political stuff you were talking about feels motivated to a real degree.
Yeah, and so you get to this point where, like you said, the Doctor and Perry are stuck in the TARDIS. At the beginning, and I 100% agree with the complaint that it just takes too many scenes to get to the point where the Doctor's like, oh, we can, like, all we need this one ore, we can go to this planet to get this ore.
I mean,
that it takes like 5 scenes to get there. It could have been 2.
Well, and that's why this feels like 4 episodes. Is why does it take that long? It's because he's supposed to arrive at the end of the first episode. Like,
exactly,
that's the cliffhanger of episode 1,
which is literally the cliffhanger of episode 1 in other regions.
Okay, that's hilarious. But yes, it's like, it's really obvious, and that first episode just, I think, has pretty bad pacing because of it being 2 episodes just pasted together at the hip.
Yeah.
It doesn't, like, because there is something about the build and release of 22-minute Doctor Who episodes that I think is really tight and good, and sometimes is even missing from modern Who sometimes. And it definitely, because they didn't really adjust the script, they just stitched it together, it's a little awkward.
Yeah, definitely. But so while that is happening, you have the public execution going on of what's that dude's name? The sort of the rebel guy
played by Sean Connery's son.
Yes, Jason Connery playing John Dar.
Yes,
which is a good, like, space guy named John Dar. And there's sort of this whole drama that's happening with him, and then he has his like fiance Aretta, that, or I don't know why I said fiance, the girlfriend character. Of John Dar.
The breeding mate.
The breeding mate, exactly, yes. The paired one is Aretta. And you have some interesting scenes that kind of, like, delve into the history of Varos in a way that I think, like, works well of them. There's a scene where she has with the one guard guy where she basically says, like, she reveals that Varos used to be a penal colony that, like, now is, like, a normal society, but the people who used to be the officers running the penal colony are still on top, and that, like, that economic... it, like, and social inequality still exists between those classes, which is exactly what happens to, like, actual penal colonies, and is what happens. I mean, you know,
it's
like,
Australia, basically.
It's Australia. It's, you know, any penal colony. It's also, I mean, you know, it's not technically a penal colony, but it's the same thing that happened with slavery in the United States. It's like anything like that, of where, like, those, even when the specific frameworks and like laws and stuff dissolve that created that inequality. The inequality remains unless something is done about it. And so that's another area where I think this episode is just very sharp about that stuff. I think, like, the writer...
Who's the writer?
He wrote one other episode, Mind Warp, which is one of the Trial of a Time Lord stories. It's a Philip Martin. So he only wrote those 2, but he's really good. And he just has, a really sharp grasp on how to build out this society and then also kind of, like, make it, like, he makes it very clear the ways that it relates to, like, normal Earth society, without it just being, like, obnoxious.
It definitely, I was going to ask if he'd written anything else in this era, because it does feel like kind of a first-time writer. Not in a bad way, just that I don't think he writes it the way Doctor Who would write these things at this time. Like, I think one of the closer analogs I could draw is to Malcolm Hulk, who's a writer in the Third Doctor era, who writes very politically motivated stories. He is probably... behind, like, your Robert Holmes and you know, Barry Letts, whatever, he's always uncredited, but his contributions, probably the most important writer of the Third Doctor era. He did, like, Doctor Who and the Silurians, and the Colony in Space, and things like that, Frontier in Space, that have these, like, very political things going on. He tends to do it in a more big space opera fashion. This is much more a, like, chamber political drama fashion.
Yeah.
But I like, you know, because Doctor Who definitely goes through periods where it's largely apolitical. Like, Tom Baker's run... pretty much apolitical with breaks here and there.
Yeah, but like, yeah, it's definitely not trying to make like direct arguments about like what is going on in politics at the time.
Yeah, so it's been a while since Classic Who has done this kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's one of those things of him being a like first time writer for the show just makes it feel fresh. It's also true of his story Mind Warp is really weird. That one is also a lot of fun because it has Brian Blessed in it. So anything with Brian Blessed in it is a joy to watch. Like Mind Warp is more inconsistent than this one, but it is. It's, yeah, like, he definitely is, like, a writer. Even with just those two episodes, you get a sense of he likes doing things that are a bit more experimental and, like, putting in kind of these, like, interesting superstructures for the show that he does with, like, the two characters that are kind of, like, that weird Greek chorus-y kind of thing. Another side of the episode that we haven't really talked about that is happening is the governor and the drama between the governor, Syl, who's the alien, the chief officer, and then Quillam, who's the weird Nazi scientist guy, who, like, because you always need a weird Nazi scientist guy in a story like this. And the governor is played by Martin Jarvis, who is a character actor that is in a lot of TV stuff. He might be better known to our audience as the voice of Alfred from the Batman Arkham games.
Oh, interesting.
Which is a really weird connection that I wasn't expecting, but it's like, I looked up his IMDb, I'm like, oh, he's the Alfred in all of the Arkham games. He's very good.
It is fitting that a man with the last name Jarvis has voiced Alfred.
He has, and like he's a very Jarvis-y kind of guy as the governor as well. It's a very like
it's a good performance.
It's a really good performance because he's like the backbone of the story to me. Like his role as like this governor who like clearly wants to do the right things for his people, but is also, he is wrapped down by this like really oppressive, strange system that is ruled by these economic forces. And then he also just doesn't quite know how to maneuver in that and know like what is the right thing to do. And you're kind of, there are points of the story where you're a bit at odds with him because he's at odds with the Doctor and Perry, but you always know that like he's trying to get around to doing the right thing. He just doesn't know what that is at that point. So Martin Jarvis as the governor, I think, is a really strong performance that has that, like, you know, British upper crust, like, leading man kind of dude that is, like, you can read some, I think, like, with Syl and the weird, like, Syl having these two weird black guys that are just, like, they're, like, carrying him around. I think you can read some weird race stuff in there, especially with, like, Martin Jarvis being this very, like, upper crusty kind of British dude, but you know, I think he pulls that role really well. And the governor character it's a really interesting role, and that sort of, it's almost like when you're relating it to modern stuff, it has this almost sort of like vaguely Obama sort of feel to it of a guy with his heart in the right place that is like so powerless because of the structures that he is within, and the you know, the government kind of being always at odds with what he's trying to do because of economic forces. It's a compelling role.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about Syl?
Yes, let's talk about Syl, played by Nabil Shaban, with what is, I think, some of the most impressive effects work of this period of Doctor Who. I think the makeup and the costuming for Syl is really fucking good for Doctor Who at this period, and the Nabil Shaban just gives 120% to playing this weird, grubby, gross alien slug guy who just sits around and gets moisturized and just laughs and cackles all the time.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious, you know, a suit where he is, like, under the prop, and then his face is in it, so it allows him to be very expressive because he's doing all the face stuff, and then I assume other people are doing all the puppetry. I do like how much the face gets to come through, because sometimes on these, like, I don't know, comparing to a Santarin or something from this era, where the faces don't really get to have any expressiveness. That's a really good part. I actually, for a while, was like, this has to be someone I recognize. It looked like Warwick Davis a little bit for a while.
Sure,
and it's not. But if you look at a picture of Nabil Shaban, it's him. Like, there is very little gap between, like, his facial structure and this character. Like, there's obviously, he's green in the episode.
Yeah.
But he's got a very expressive, like, particular facial quality. And he uses it very well in this.
Yes, Syl also is a character that he shows up in the other episode written by this guy, Mind Warp. So,
and multiple Big Finish dramas, because that's how Big Finish rolls.
And he is an extremely memorable character, and it's one of the issues with this era of the show, I think, is that there is a lack of memorable like supporting characters and a lack of memorable villains in particular.
Oh God, even in Revelation of the Daleks, like Davros is the most boring fucking villain.
Yeah,
in that.
He's like barely in it, and he just sort of shows up. Yeah, like, Syl is this really memorable presence. Like I think you could maybe argue that it's being hammed up a little bit too much in places, but that is how I like it. So it's like...
It works.
Yeah, it always sticks out to me as one of, like, the highlights of this era with Colin Baker is you have this weird Syl character that you can very much tell. Because it's also, like you can tell the inspiration for a lot of those Russell T. Davis monsters, but I think Syl is better than those. Like, there's something...
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's a heart to the performance that comes across, that you really believe this, like, weird character in a way that is kind of hard to express, but I think it really comes down to the performance.
I also think, like, Syl's particular grotesqueness is motivated by the story and the themes a little more than, like, the farting Slitheen or the Lovin' Monsters dude or...
The Absorbaloff, you mean?
The Absorbaloff? Oh, Jesus Christ. I do kind of like Lady Cassandra in her episodes, but even then, like, there's not as much, I think, there with the character. Partially, that's also a completely CGI character from 2005, which, different kind of thing. But yeah, no, I warmed to Syl by the end. He is a good foe for the Doctor, especially because the Doctor doesn't seem to take him particularly seriously, which is funny.
Yeah, no. So then, what else did we have to talk about from the first episode? So then, because we also have that Quillen character that shows up a little bit. But the chief officer played by Forbes Collins, who's the bald dude with the mustache. I like that dude.
He looks like a character from a video game.
Yeah, he did. That's a really good way to put it. Like, you look at that dude and you 100% understand his role in the plot immediately. Like, you look at that, like, that bald head and that mustache and, like, the black Nazi-ish outfit that he has on is like... I know that guy. Like, I don't know. I have not actually looked up Forbes Collins and what else he has been in. I don't know if I've seen anything else he's been in. But, like, you just know immediately that character, and he's just got that fucking look down pat.
No, it's good. Yeah. And so the first episode is really all set up, because by the end of that first episode, you sort of have your party together of the Doctor and Perry, and you have John Darr and his breeding partner.
Yes, Aretta.
And it's basically those four running around the catacombs on Varos in a strange execution game where they keep getting... Like, this is one of the ultimate... The Doctor gets captured, he gets away, he gets captured, he gets away, he gets captured, he gets away. And that's, like, the whole episode from there.
Yeah.
But it really isn't until that party comes together that the plot fully kicks into motion. And then you start to understand, oh, right, this is why it pissed off old white ladies.
Right, yeah. So there's a couple of things in the sort of like the cat and mouse game in the catacombs of Varus that I want to point out. It's like it's a cheesy effect, but I always really like when they get to the corridor with the giant fly. Like,
I like that. Yeah,
there's something about that, just like the brazenness of like how obvious the effect is like fucking yeah. Like that's cool. That works for me. I think Colin Baker acts very well pretending that there's a fly on his shoulder and plucking out the fly and all that. Like it's. That little bit is good. And then the ending of episode one, the cliffhanger it ends on of Colin Baker getting separated from Perry and the others and being stuck in this, like, hallway that he thinks is a desert or something. Like, they're very vague about how any of this shit actually works. It's just sort of like, it's a hallucination matrix field majiggity-doo.
They do have a long technobabble at some point about how it brings out, like, fears from your mind and, like, actualizes them through... Something, something, something.
Yeah.
But I do like it as a setup because I think there is a good, like, torture chamber aspect to these two episodes where the gauntlet they are in continues to transform and change. And I do think the cliffhanger at episode one is great.
Yes. Yeah. Because then another bit of good gobbledygook is with the fly bit. I love that they keep calling it the purple zone, which is the least intimidating name for anything. It's like... That sounds like it's a part of, like, a fucking, like, amusement park. It's like, hey, kids, let's go to the Purple Zone!
It's an episode of Barney the Dinosaur.
Exactly. Like, we'll go play with Barney in the Purple Zone. But no, the Purple Zone, you know, magnifies, like, insects to make them look gigantic. But yeah, and then Colin Baker is trudging through this imaginative desert and basically collapses and almost dies. And it is a moment that always sticks out to me in Doctor Who. It's probably, like... Of all of Colin Baker's stories, this is, like, the moment in any of them that sticks out to me the most is that cliffhanger of him collapsing, and this is where they do all the framing stuff of the governor and everyone back at the sort of control room. The governor's telling them how to frame the shot, and it's like, and zoom in, and hold, and hold, and hold, and cut. And then it cuts, like, you see the screens cut, and then the episode cuts to credits. I think like that is so well executed. I think it's really effective.
It's one of the better Doctor Who cliffhangers I've ever seen. It is in the top like 20 or something.
Yeah, like wrapping the danger that the Doctor is in, and then like bringing it to this frame narrative that is talking about like television and the way that we consume violence, and like just putting that right in front of your face right when it cuts. Yeah, it is really well done.
Yeah, it's maybe the best moment of these two episodes to me. Not that like, because I actually think the second episode is much stronger overall, but yeah, that cliffhanger is fucking great.
Yeah, it's really fucking good. And so then you start episode 2/episode 3 in a normal Doctor Who serial. And this is where you get the infamous acid sequence where the Doctor is not actually dead. He is just unconscious. And I guess
they never explain how he survived.
If the two people in the room go like, oh, he must have been pretending. It's like, what? What do you mean he must be pretending to be? Like, how would he know that they would then take him to this weird room? And he'd be like, anyways, yeah. So he somehow survives the desert room. He surpasses the purple zone, survives the desert room, gets taken to the acid room. This is where I think my second favorite use of the framing device, and I think the funniest bit in the story, is this little kind of throwaway line in the acid room where the two guards have brought the Doctor in, and then they pick up this other body or something in this big bag and throw it in the acid, and then it cuts back to the two people in the room, and the guy says the reason they do that to show you how corrosive the acid is, which is a like weird meta commentary on that is why in the scripting you do shit like that. That's why, you know, like if James Bond is being dangled above a pool full of sharks, the villain's gonna like throw a stake in to see the sharks tear up the stake, is like set up the danger of it. And I like that weird little like throwaway meta joke there.
Yeah.
And that's where then the Doctor wakes up, sees that he is in a weird acid room and surrounded by two Nazi-looking motherfuckers, and he gets up, and the world cried out. He threw two people into acid, and I cried. Well, technically one of them tripped, and then he pulled the other one in with him.
He tripped because the Doctor was, like, pushing him towards it.
I mean, the Doctor was trying to not be thrown into a pool of acid himself. So he was defending himself with the big, like tray or whatever it is he had.
It is a really interesting moment to pick apart. Because one of the things it makes me think of, because this does feel just markedly more extreme than I think any other piece of violence I've seen on Doctor Who. Part of it is the sheer grotesqueness of it, that they are taking dead bodies and on TV for entertainment, throwing them in acid to watch them dissolve. Like, it's fucked up. And they even have the line of like, well, even if he's not dead, this'll do it. Like, we're gonna throw a live man into acid, and then two live people are thrown in, and there is a fairly graphic shot of one of them, like graphic for what they could show, coming out and like his, you know, skin melting off like he's Harvey Dent in Batman or something, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty messed up. And one of the moments it made me think of like another one that from the Tom Baker era that really made me sit up and take notice, is it's in The Seeds of Doom, which is a great fucking story. I think it's the finale to season 13. It's his second season finale. And that's just a great fucking story. It's sort of like three two-parters thrown together, and the first one is like the John Carpenter's The Thing out in like Antarctic, and then eventually it's more of like a house in the British countryside narrative. But anyway, in the last couple episodes, the villain has this like wood chopper thing, like Fargo style, that he's trying to kill Sarah Jane with. And of course, Sarah Jane does not get killed that way. But the villain does get like thrown into it, and you have this reaction shot of the Doctor like looking at his body getting chewed up and going, Tom Baker going, ew, you know, that kind of thing. And that is one of those moments where I'm like, how did they get that on the fucking air?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't know what it is. This feels more extreme than that. Part of it is that you see more of it.
Yeah.
But also, like, it's just, I don't know. There, again, The Seeds of Doom is working within a certain genre construct by which that sort of thing in that sort of horror movie, gothic horror thing they're doing at the time fits. It's extreme and it's shocking, but it fits. This is one of those where, I'm not going to say it doesn't fit with this story, but you do get to it, and because it doesn't feel like the scene has a clear read on how it's presenting this incredible act of violence to us, or what the Doctor's reaction is to that, it leaves you a little uneasy, and this is one of those cases where I do understand why, you know, parents in the 1980s were a little peeved by this.
Yeah, no, I definitely get it. It is a weird, it just feels, and it's the kind of thing of that, I forget what the specifics of what people working on it said, but it is the people like who worked on the story always say it's like it wasn't quite executed the way that it was like envisioned. I don't know what that means, because it is like on paper it's like I could think there are ways to have played it more seriously or more jokingly that would have made it probably better. It is that, like, there's... It goes this weird middle ground of, like, what you see is pretty fucking gruesome. But then I think what really does it for me is the doctor at the end has this line, "You'll forgive me if I don't join you," where he sort of daintily like casually like throws his jacket over his shoulder with like hanging with his two hands like he's some fucking like James Dean motherfucker, and like is like halfway up the ladder and he looks down and he says, don't mind if I don't join you, and then he goes up the ladder and it's like, what? like it's like a weird, it's an uncharacteristic one liner in a really dark situation like that, that I think for me that is the point where it doesn't really work for me, like as a scene, like regardless of like thinking about the kids or something like that, it's just like on its own merits the scene just, yeah, it doesn't.
Well, and again, like, this is a relatively new doctor, we're still like trying to solidify his character, right? And it's an extreme moment that the episode doesn't necessarily do anything with. Like, if you think of, again, back to the 12th Doctor example,
yeah,
when violent things happen in his first season, they don't happen and then there's no discussion of it. It becomes a big thing between, like, him and Clara or him and another character on screen, and it is sort of talked about. Like, again, it would be like if, you know, imagine if next season we're excited to see Jodie Whittaker's new doctor, and then in episode 3 she throws two people into a vat of acid and it's never mentioned again. You'd be like, what happened, Doctor? That's pretty extreme.
I think the thing it actually reminds me of the most in modern Doctor Who is the end of Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, where the Doctor just fires David Bradley off into space and just watches him get fucking destroyed and blown up by missiles. And it's just like, and he doesn't say anything. None of the other characters know that it just happened. And it was like, and we talked about that story on the podcast at the time. It was like, that's kind of fucking weird. Like, that's really, I think we were like theorizing at the time that it was like, there's got to be some dark twist that's going to come like halfway through the season that explains why the Doctor's so fucking weird in these stories.
Yes.
It's like, that's just, well, so that, uncharacteristic.
That one's also a little weird, though, because Matt Smith was a pretty well-established Doctor at that point. That's his last season, so, like, it was extra out of character because he's not a trigger-happy Doctor, particularly.
Yeah.
So that was weird, but yes.
Yeah, it's just something where it's like, the execution for something like that is really important, because if you don't land it quite right and you don't sort of, like, unpack the, like, what you just did on screen, it, like, the audience doesn't know how to take it, right? It's like, you don't know, it's like, is the Doctor just, like, sort of gleefully murdering people at this point? It's like, what is going on? If you don't deal with it, the audience doesn't know how to deal with it.
All right. So where do we go from? What other things to talk about in the second episode?
Other stuff that starts happening. Let's talk a little bit about Quillam, the weird Nazi doctor with the mask that feels like they watched Caves of Androzani and the villain in that, and they're like, we could do that again. It's like Quillam in his role and the transmogrification machine that starts turning Perry into a bird and stuff is the stuff in Vincenzo Navarro's, I think, is kind of the weakest to me.
Yeah, I didn't remember it until you just mentioned it, and I watched it last night.
It's the stuff that feels like you can really tell, like, the sort of, like, the four-episode structure of classic Doctor Who that, like, they just sort of pretended that it's a new structure because they stitched the episodes together to make it two, is that, like, it is one of the best examples of, like, the wheel-spinning third episode shit I can think of that the cliffhanger for the third episode would be the Doctor and the Governor trying to go and, like, stop Perry and Jondar's breeding pair from being transmogrified into animals. That just feels like it was made to be able to pad out the length of the episodes, and, like, the couple of scenes that Quillam, the weird Nazi dude, appears in, mostly feel like they're a justification for that, with the exception of one moment I think is fucking badass and awesome, which is when the Doctor sees that, like, on the screen or whatever is being projected, that Perry is being turned into this bird creature, and the Doctor's like, you will stop this now, and the Governor, like, orders Quillam, like, you have to stop, because we kind of skipped a little bit ahead, but we'll go back to the hanging scene where the Doctor and the Governor are on the same side now, and Quillam's like, no, I am a permanent position, not some temporary Governor, like, you don't got shit on me, buddy. And so the Doctor's response to that is just, he fucking grabs a gun and just blows up the panel, just, like, fires at it, like, 5 times.
It's a good moment.
It's just the Colin, there's a couple of moments in Colin Baker's run, as short as it is, where he just straight up fucking blasts shit with a gun. His first story in this season of the Attack of the Cybermen or something like that, there's a part where he just like slides on the ground and just fires up straight into Cyberman's chest with a ray gun about a dozen times, and it's fucking awesome. It's another scene that people point out. It's like, this is weirdly violent and gruesome because the Cyberman's like blowing up, but it's fucking cool.
Yes. It's also just a Cyberman. What are you playing about?
It's trying to, you know, turn you into an emotionless monster. You should get shot in the chest with a cool ray gun, as long as it's done by a cool dude with a bright coat on.
Speaking of Perry, we haven't talked about her yet.
Oh, right. Yeah, we should address Perpigilliam Brown and Nicola Bryant and...
Two things. Yeah. I love that they thought Perpigilliam is a recognizably American name.
When it's like the most Roald Dahl-ass name ever.
Yes. They're like, what name will immediately signal to people that this is an American? Bridget? No.
Sarah?
Becky?
Jane?
Perpigilliam?
Yeah, that's really good, but it's a bit of a mouthful. Perry! Oh, I know hundreds of American women named Perry.
Yes.
It's like, I don't even know if I'm going to type in Perpigilliam. I've never heard the name Perpigilliam or Perry outside of the context of Doctor Who. And I typed in Perpigilliam, and the first thing that came up was just Doctor Who. So,
yes.
I think they just made that name up.
Yes, or again, Roald Dahl name generator.
Exactly. But yes,
I love that they think Perpigilliam slash Perry is a recognizably American name, and I love that they think Nicola Bryant can do a convincing American accent.
It is something where I literally forgot that she's supposed to be an American character until they do the joke in the first episode where she's like reading the TARDIS manual and she says something about like, oh, an A to Z, and the doctor looks up, I think you mean Z, and it's like, yeah, whatever. It's like, oh, right, she's supposed to be American. I 100% forgot that, because that is not an American accent at all.
It's weird, because it's also like, I love seeing when other cultures try to do American, like, what is the stereotypical American accent? Because there is none, really, in America, because there's lots of, it's a big fucking country. But it usually goes some kind of southern sort of twang. She basically sounds like she is trying to do, like, a, you know, light Nashville twang on her normal British voice.
Yeah, with, like, a little bit of, like, California Valley Girl in there, kind of.
But, yeah, that's more of an inflection thing than an accent thing. But, yeah, it's bizarre. I do think Nicola Bryant could have been a fun companion on the whole. She's got good chemistry with Colin Baker. Not always, but I think in this one.
Yeah.
I think she's a decent screen presence. It's very tough to gauge because she is kind of the epitome of the non-character companion. Like, I can't really tell you anything about Perry. I do think she's a nice presence in this episode, I guess.
Yeah, it's something of I think Nicola Bryant is good with what she is given and allowed to do. I think she does have really good chemistry with Colin Baker, which like is more clear in the couple of... Because she's only in two stories in Trial of the Time Lord, because that's where she kind of like, quote-unquote, dies, but doesn't die. It's very confusing what happens to Perry. She kind of like, quote-unquote, dies halfway through Trial of the Time Lord, and you're introduced to Mel out of order, and it's very fucking confusing. But in Mysterious Planet and Mind Warp, which are the two stories she's in, you definitely get a better sense of, like, they write the character so that she's not quite at odds with the Doctor as much as she is in this first season, and you get that sense of, like, Colin Baker and her have, like, a good rapport, and they work well together. But it is, like, saddling her with that accent, her not having much of a definable character. Like, there's a little bit of a, like, she's supposed to be, like, an herbologist or some shit in Planet of Fire, which is because she's introduced in Planet of Fire.
That never comes up again.
Yeah, the penultimate Peter Davison stories where she's introduced. Then in Caves of Androzani is the first, like, full story she's a part of, and they immediately abandon that aspect of her character. She's just sort of, like, American in this weird, like, ancillary sense. This is one of those of where the actual reason she's American is because reruns of Doctor Who were being showed on PBS in America, and Johnny the Turner was like, there's a new audience, let's make an American companion. Should we hire an American actress to do that? No, that's okay. Like, Nicola Bryant can do it, I guess. Can she do an American accent? No, but fuck it, we'll just make that the character. It's like, I don't blame Nicola Bryant for any of that shit, because she's a really good actress. She's just saddled with stuff. The other issue I have with Perry is that she is, I think, by far the most blatantly sexualized companion the show has ever had. Like, the outfit she has in this story is basically the outfit she has in most of her stories, which is these short shorts and what is basically a leotard with, like, a, like, ridiculous plunging neckline. And it is something of that, like, every time she's running down a corridor, it's like, It makes me uncomfortable because, like, that has got that. It looks like it fucking hurts because she does not have the support she needs.
It's
just like it's really tasteless.
It is actually kind of a weird thing with as much Doctor Who as both you and I have seen. It's surprising when you see cleavage that way.
Yeah,
because that's just not, at least in that context. Like, there are other contexts, like maybe a fancy dress kind of thing is different.
Yeah, like, but some of the outfits that, like, River Song has in modern Doctor Who.
Sure, but that's not ever sexualized to the same kind of degree. Like, this is just leering, and it's a really weird and, I think, bad, obviously, fit for Doctor Who, and a bad taste sort of thing for Doctor Who.
And it just doesn't make any sense for the character. There's no world in which a person that is, like, been transported to this fucking, like, weird penal colony that's, like, this death labyrinth. Or, yeah, like, going anywhere in time and space where you have no idea where you're going to go is going to wear high heels, short shorts, and this, like, skin-tight top with a plunging neckline. Nobody's going to dress that way. Because it's like, you're dressing like this weird high school girl. Like, that's not, it makes no sense. You're not dressing, like, in any practical way.
Yeah.
It's like, there's no world in which that character dresses herself like that. She's very obviously being dressed that way. And, like, Nicola Bryan has said in interviews, it's like, she didn't choose that costume.
No,
that's
not
what she wanted to wear. That's what she was put into.
It is like, it is kind of interesting that in the 50 plus now year history of Doctor Who, 55 years this year, that, you know, it has different issues with representations of women throughout its run. Although I would think on the whole, it's a pretty positive show for actresses,
yeah,
and for female representations in terms of how it treats its female characters. And one of the things it almost never does outside of this era is that overt leering male gaze. It's pretty good throughout its history of avoiding that. Often in periods when that would be way outside the norm, you know, for,
yeah,
how women are treated on a sort of a male-led television show, at least. It's just always a surprising thing when you go to a Perry episode, and a disappointing one, to remember that Doctor Who did this for a couple of years, because it's just odd more than anything,
yeah,
for the show.
Because it doesn't do it past this point, and it didn't really do it before this. Like, the closest thing you get is Leela, and even that's not, like, sexualized in quite the same way. Like, it's not, I'm not, like, 100% excusing it, but I think they execute the idea a little bit better.
Yeah, Leela's a weird case, because, like, I think, and you even hear on, like, the bonus features about Leela that everyone, up to and including Louise Jameson, have weird, kind of conflicted feelings about that costume.
Yeah.
But I think they also, you hear them say this, it's more revealing on set than it is on camera in a weird way.
Yeah.
Because on camera, when you have, like, a certain kind of color scheme and set, like, it can fit more. And she's also not in that in all her stories. It's,
yeah,
maybe half of them. But it is a, it's, yeah, that would probably be the closest, yeah.
Yeah, but, like, at least in that case, again, I don't want to 100% excuse it, because part of it is definitely to make it titillating in some,
yes,
ways. But at least they tried to create a character that has some excuse to dress up. I mean, they went with the Tarzan thing.
Yeah.
It's like, the Perry character has no reason to dress like this.
Yeah, Leela is one of the best-written companions in Doctor Who history.
Yeah.
Perry is not.
Exactly.
We have come a long way from Sarah Jane.
Oh, yeah,
let's just say that.
Yeah.
We had a great run for a while. It's been a while since this show had a great companion.
Yeah.
So.
But I want to stress again that, like none of that falls on Nicola Bryan.
No.
She's really good. And, like, especially in the Big Finish stuff. Like, she has gotten better at the American accent as well.
Okay, nice.
Yeah.
I think you strip a lot of that stuff away. I always think she's an interesting presence on screen. Like, it's not like one of those where I look at Nicola Bryant in Doctor Who and I don't understand why they cast her. I can totally understand what the things are that would lead you to be like, she would make a good companion.
Yeah.
There's no mystery to that element of it, I don't think. So, you know.
Yeah.
She's not Adric. That's good.
That is a good point. She's not Adric, you know.
And
I think it's kind of up in the air which has a worse costume, Adric or Perry. Because it's like, they're bad for different reasons.
Yeah.
But boy, does Adric have that fucking weird, like,
at least Adric gets launched into the sun, so it's okay.
Well, no, he's not the sun. He gets launched into prehistoric Earth. Please. He's the reason why the dinosaurs aren't around anymore.
Okay. I thought that was in City of Death. No, that's a different thing.
No, that's okay. A different thing. That's okay. The creation of life itself.
Okay.
It's kind of similar in some ways, but it's actually completely different.
Okay. All right, we are running low on time, so what other things should we say about Vengeance on Varos? Getting back to, like, the main story. There's that hanging scene that is another thing we're watching the Doctor in his silly fucking multicolored coat with a noose around his neck and, like, getting, you know, he doesn't actually, like, get hung, but the moment where it, like, you know, they pull the lever and he, you know, it falls, it is just, like, you know, even as an adult, a mildly traumatizing thing to see.
Yeah, no, it's, but I really like that scene.
It's
overall
a good scene.
I think, like, particularly having the Governor and the Doctor, that's the first time they meet, and I think they play off each other really well, and just Colin Baker in this whole episode is really good with, like, being the, because you kind of get the sense that, like, he's slowly piecing together, like, what's going on over the course of the story, and that scene is where he kind of, like, he asks that one question of, like, like, what was something about the ore, and when he gets the answer from Syl, it's like, that's when you realize, okay, he's put it all together.
There's a small time travel element to this, where in the first episode, he says to Perry, we're going to go to Varos, but we have to get to a time period where they were miners.
Yeah.
And you get the sense that he's landed too early. He knows they will become, like, a prosperous society, but they haven't yet, and so he's doing these little nudges to get them there.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting, like, it's not overplayed at all. It's not like, you know, a Stephen Moffat thing where they have a long soliloquy about changing time or anything, but it is an interesting undercurrent to the episode.
Yeah, and so I like that scene, I like that dynamic, and I think that, like, that is where Colin Baker just gets to play that good moment with the Governor and Syl, where he, you just see it in his head. He just very quietly, I think he asked Syl, like, what are you doing here? And Syl's like, oh, I'm here to represent this Archimedes. And he's like, okay. It's like, okay, that's it. It's like, you know that the Doctor is now going to settle all this bullshit. And then from there, it is just sort of, I think, a pretty standard Doctor Who conclusion. You know, it's you get a little bit of good running around in the catacombs again.
You get, I think, Colin Baker's, what I've seen at least, most iconic visual moment where he, like, has to put the hand out and, like, do the, like, dramatic pose in the corridor. But that's, like, every, if you Google Colin Baker Doctor, that's the picture.
Yes, yeah. It's either that or him with the umbrella from, the rainbow umbrella from The Mysterious Planet. Like, those are the two visuals, yeah, that they definitely pull from. This is where so they go through that forest of death. This is where I think, like, quietly the most gruesome, like, kind of thing happens in the whole series, which is they run into two cannibals that are chasing after them, and the Doctor just, like, has this great line where he says, like, oh, we ran past, because they're like, who are these people? What's wrong with them? It's like, oh, we ran past some skeletons on the way that I noticed. I think that they think we're dinner. It's like,
yeah, that's an interesting part. The Doctor also rigs something so someone will be poisoned by the vines and die of that. So.
Yeah, he has the Jondar pull the vine back with some string and so it slaps him, because that's, they actually kill basically all the villains other than Syl that way.
Yes.
They just get hit in the face with vines.
Yes, the Doctor does have amass a certain body count in this one.
Yes, because I think he also kills indirectly one person with the ray gun.
Yes,
Before the acid bath. So it's like he already had a bit of a kill count going before the two people accidentally fall into the acid bath.
It is surprising.
Yeah. I just want to say with the cannibal thing, the thing that is gruesome about it is not that the cannibals are there, it's that there's a really quick shot where one of the cannibals gets killed with the poisonous vine, and there's like half of a second before it cuts away where you see the other cannibal grab that dude and start pulling him back to imply that that cannibal is now going to eat the other cannibal now that the other cannibal is dead. That is like the most gruesome implication I think that Doctor Who has ever had, that there's two people have been trapped in this like psychological mind-fucking like catacombs to the point where they have become cannibals, and the only two people they have are each other, and then when one of them dies, the other's like, well, here's lunch now. And that's like, the implication there is really dark.
I think we need a big Finnish audio drama about what happens after he pulls the body away.
Me too, yeah. It'll be a dark experiment, like psychological experiment, like character study.
Gonna have to get those bone crunching sounds in there.
Exactly. I think they probably have a couple of those.
I also wanted to say that set near the end of the forest is, most of this episode is cheap. It's not particularly well directed. It's very rudimentary in a way a lot of these are, but that set near the end, like the colors and everything are really interesting, very detailed. It's the most, I think, like inspired staging of the two episodes.
I agree.
And I do like that stuff a lot.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so from there, I don't think there's that much to talk about with the climax. It's sort of like the Doctor has exposed everything about like the scam that Syl is running and how much the ore is actually valuable. The Governor, they kill all those people in the forest. The Governor kind of regains control. The people sort of vote for him is like, okay, good, like we can do this. We can rebuild this society now. But it does have that really great ending. I think like this has one of my favorite endings in Doctor Who, where it goes back to that sort of that frame narrative of the two people in the room, and they're like, I have the lines here, no more executions, torture, nothing, it's all changed, we're free, are we? Yes. What shall we do? Don't know. And then it cuts to the screen, and the screen is static, and like that is such a good haunting ending that's like the it walks the line between like being optimistic and pessimistic about the future of the society. That's like we have this chance to build something, but it's also like they had like the general populace doesn't know what to do with the freedom that they have just earned.
Yes, it is. No, this episode I think sticks all the major moments. It's, as I said, I don't know if it's the my like an episode I think is great as a Doctor Who episode, because I don't know if it, you know, breaks any new molds for me. You know, certainly like some of the ones we've talked about before now, like the Aztecs or Tomb of the Cybermen or something like that. But I think it's a really, really solid one. Very good. And it is good to have at least one Colin Baker story out there that just hits all the fundamental notes very well for me. And goes above and beyond in some other ways.
Yeah, I think I like it more than you do. I think it has, to me, I think like that social commentary element of it is really sharp. It definitely has some pacing issues, which is not uncommon of Doctor Who in this year at all. But it like you said, like all the like important things it needs to nail, I think it went 100% nails. And it just has some of those like really cinematic moments that particularly like this, the John Nathan Turner years just didn't have a lot of that stuff. And it's, you know, hard to pick out, like, because I think Kinda is a story that has some of those moments, and then this one definitely has a lot of those moments, and it's something that is, like, when Doctor Who is in decline, it's always encouraging when you go back and sort of, like, look at it, when you're not just, like, watching them all in a row, and be able to be like, no, like, this one's really fucking good. Like, Doctor Who didn't have to be bad right now. There are a lot of really talented people working on it, and that's like what I said at the kind of at near the top of this episode is like a show that is totally creatively bankrupt would not be able to produce a story like this. Like there's a lot of magic still that was still going on behind the scenes, and a lot of great people like Colin Baker working there. That if other people had gotten behind the production, like Doctor Who, I think could have still had that high standard of quality it had before this point.
Awesome. Yep. Anything else to say about Mr. Colin Baker and Vengeance on Varos?
If you know, watch Vengeance on Varos and you like Colin Baker, check out some of his stories on Big Finish, because he's really fucking good.
Do you have any like particular ones to recommend?
Jubilee is the obvious go-to. I think any of his stories with Evelyn Smythe are all really good, who's the sort of like elderly like history professor that he starts traveling with. Any of those are great. Yeah, he's awesome.
Okay, awesome. Do you want to go ahead and give our preview for next month, where we will reach the end of classic Doctor Who?
Yes, so next month we will be doing our Sylvester McCoy story, and this is one I had a lot of trouble figuring out what to do. I thought, like, I couldn't do Battlefield, even though that would still be my instinct to do that one, but we already did it, and my mission statement was, I'm not going to do one we did, even if it's on, like, three podcast names ago. So maybe we'll talk about Battlefield again someday, but I put that one
not
off the
yet,
table.
Yeah.
The Remembrance of the Daleks was another one I toyed with, but that's a big anniversary story. I'm like, that like feels weird to do an anniversary story. I want to pick something that's representative. And the issue I had was I was then left with one of three stories that is the trilogy of stories that he is that like kind of close out Sylvester McCoy's era that kind of delve into the past of his companion Ace. I was like, well, you know, Survival's really good. Curse of Vinric is also really good. But that's, like, the third and second story in that trilogy. And it feels kind of weird to pick one of those two. So I, like, was left with a choice that I had initially dismissed offhand. And then looking at the story again, I was like, no, this is 100% the story we're going to watch. So next month, we are going to watch Ghostlight, which is the first story in the Cartmel's Master Plan trilogy that closes out the era of classic Doctor Who. And just to prepare people, Ghostlight is one of the most bizarre stories in the history of Doctor Who. It is weird. It is strange. It is uncanny. It is bizarre. I think it is also utterly gripping, captivating, and just absorbing in a way that few Doctor Who stories really are. It's one I desperately love. It's one I haven't seen in a long time. So the other reason why I'm picking it is I like very selfishly just that one excuse to watch it again. But I think people should go into it like understanding that like it is confusing on purpose. Like it is a really complicated script. So like do not like zone out while watching it. It rewards repeat viewings and it rewards paying attention to. And I'm very happy to finish this. I think it is an unconventional choice, but it is a choice that I will stand by, and I'm excited to talk about Ghostlight
awesome.
Next time on Doctor Who.
And we will see where we go from there after that.
It's, who knows? The story of Doctor Who is long and strange, and there might be other stories to talk about beyond the cancellation of 1989.